Just gonna show a video of the song "I Love LA" by Randy Newman. Came out in 1983. And he's a really, really amazing musician over many decades. And it's kind of a satirical song. He puts LA in a great light, but he knows very well the ills of that city. And in it, he's driving around in a beautiful, restored 1950s era convertible, driving around all the different parts of the city and the beautiful weather and all that. Except, how many of you have been to LA or lived in LA? Okay, a good number. A couple of years ago, I had some church business I had to do in LA. And I was able to rent a car. And just for a few dollars more, I was able to rent a Mustang convertible. I had to get to my church business faster that day, so I justified it in that way. It's like, yeah, this... Anyway, I was having a good time taking it from LAX to different parts, but my goodness, weather was beautiful and sunny and everything, but I was crawling at 10 to 15 miles per hour anywhere I was going. And when you're going that slow, and with the LA smog, it's really difficult to enjoy this top-down experience. I had to raise the top and turn on the AC to protect myself from the beating sun and the smog. So we think about a day like this. Does it make any sense to have a convertible car in Minnesota? Does it make any sense to have a swimming pool up here? That's one of the strangest things. I could not wrap my mind around people in Minnesota who had swimming pools. But for those who do, God bless you. And remember to invite me in the summer. But most people don't buy. It's not like Minnesota is a top 10 market for convertible cars in the United States. And there's a reason for that. So we think about living in a time like this and thinking, why can't I be in LA? Right? California dreaming, they call it. Until we realize what life there is really like. My family immigrated to the United States in 1975. And we landed at LA International Airport, LAX. LAX is the Ellis Island of the West Coast for Asian people and many other immigrants. And I didn't know much at the age of 7. We only lived there for a few months before moving to the Deep South. But I've been back many times, still have some family and lots of friends there. And it's difficult to understand a city with millions and millions of people with no credible public transportation. In our couples ministry event yesterday, we kind of talked about that as an illustration of what is going on in our nation. And we talked about how in the 1920s and 30s, when Los Angeles had major bankruptcies in parts of its public sector. The trolley cars, the electric trolley cars, that whole system went bankrupt. And what happened was that Detroit auto companies, who were very wealthy already by that time, even though they had no direct interest in those trolleyways, bought up all the public access roads among themselves so that LA could never build a subway system or public transportation again, and that it would be designed around highways. In Los Angeles, they call it freeways, which is interesting. In the rest of the country, we call it highways. And they have a kind of one public kind of ethic that they will not charge tolls. So I'm not exactly sure if the term freeway comes from that reference. But anyway, LA is just crisscrossed by freeways all over the place. But it is a city built on the car culture. And because of zoning laws and maybe because of earthquakes, they don't really have high-rise apartments either. So people are living in very low-rise houses or apartments and spread all over the place without any truly functional public transportation. So despite all the freeways, you're free to crawl at about 10 to 15 miles per hour at best. It easily takes 2 hours to traverse 12 miles from one part of LA to another. And that's why, despite 7-month-long winters here in Minnesota, I, knowing that, don't really have any desire to live in a place like that. Because the number of times I visited and had to drive, the hours and hours of waste on the road, spewing all those carbon emissions, and sitting in the car trying to get somewhere just seem unbearable. I like efficiency. That's part of my personality. And the inefficiency of LA life, I think, would drive me crazy. But like I said, part of the reason why LA is constructed that way is because automobile manufacturers wanted to sell cars. And if you can have a city built around the car culture, then you're going to sell a lot more cars, of course. The major automakers, whether from Detroit or Japan or Korea or Germany, all have major design studios in the LA area. So it's a very, very important city for that industry. And that was replicated all over the country. And we've really, really done some damage to our downtowns that way. I mean, in Atlanta, where I'm from, we have I-75, I-85, I-20, all intersecting the heart of that beautiful historic downtown area, ringed by a 285 circular highway. Here in the Twin Cities, we have I-94 that connects through Madison to Chicago, and we have kind of local major highways, but also 35, which goes from Minneapolis to Duluth, but also south to Dallas. Do you know that if you take 35 straight down, you'll hit Dallas? And we have a 494, 694 loop around the Twin Cities. This is all very intentionally designed and propagated by automobile companies and oil and gas industries to create a culture where we have to drive everywhere. Do you know that if you go to Africa, Latin America, Asia, and Europe, you'll find people who work on Main Street, and then when they close their business, they go right upstairs and sleep in the residence in the second, third, fourth floor above that building? I have an uncle who lives in a southern port city where my dad is from in South Korea, and he lives very well. But his business is probably the public part of his business is probably the size of our corner cafe. And in the evening, he and his wife go upstairs, and that's where they sleep. And their sleeping, their living space is not much bigger than the corner cafe. But he plays golf all the time, and he owns a BMW. I don't know how he commutes from upstairs to downstairs in that BMW. Yeah. But he has one. And by the way, Church of All Nations also has one. Yes. A friend of one of our members donated a 1996 318i with several hundred thousand miles, and it wasn't working, but we got it for free. Turbo Tim got it working for a couple hundred dollars and said, we're going to need several thousand dollars. And then we went to some of our members and said, well, what do you think? And they said, we don't know anything about cars, but we're interested, so let us fix it. So that's what we do. So where's Josiah? Josiah and Paul Moses and Robert Lee put it in one of their garages. And for a couple of months now, looking at YouTube videos and other things, put in several thousand dollars worth of repairs for only $400. So it's a great deal. Yep. So please tell your friends and neighbors about what an awesome church Church Fall Nations is. You know, there's some churches with 15 passenger vans, but how many churches do you know that have a BMW? That's elite. That's right. So, I love LA. We have zoning laws where residential is strictly residential and business is strictly business. Why? To force us to drive, unlike everybody else in the rest of the world, who, if they can, will walk or take a bike or even just go up and downstairs to their business. In other words, we have fallen asleep. We have let some people take the wheel of our society, so to speak, and fallen asleep. And we think that living in one place and driving 15, 30 minutes, an hour to work somewhere is normal. You know what that is? That's crazy. That's not only crazy, that is dumb. And that is also unsustainable. We're killing ourselves, killing our time, killing our families, and killing the earth while we live this kind of lifestyle designed by Detroit auto companies and the oil companies of this country. And we're all asleep because we've been doing this for so many years. We think life has always been like this. Some Europeans created the modern gas combustion engine in the mid-1800s. And it was Henry Ford in the U.S. that turned that into mass manufacturing for automobiles. That was in the early 1900s. You know, a few years ago, we did a funeral for Grandma Evelyn Gullickson in our church. She was born in 1903 and became a member of Shiloh Bethany at the age of 14. And she was 108 when we celebrated that beautiful life. She was born before the Model T. She was born in a time when people went back and forth by walking and on horses and in electric trolleys in streets, including here in Minneapolis and St. Paul. I don't think that for Grandma Evelyn, working in one place and living far away in another and driving everywhere is automatic. She was not born into that world. That world became so in her lifetime. And many, many of us here knew Grandma Evelyn personally. That's how much our world has changed that quickly. And because we've fallen asleep, because we've forgotten, we think that that kind of lifestyle is not only universal, which it is not, but we're making it universal, right? But also inevitable, as if it has always been and it always will be. It's the notion of inevitability that paralyzes us from acting differently and living better. Now, concerning the times and the seasons, brothers and sisters, the Apostle Paul says, you do not need to have anything written to you. Like, you know this. For you yourselves know very well that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. And then he says, when they say, when you hear around you, there is peace and security, then sudden destruction will come upon them as labor pains come upon a pregnant woman, and there will be no escape. This peace and security was the dominant propagandistic phrase of the Roman Empire in the first century. The Roman Empire was spouting peace and security all over the empire, and that was also the deal of the Pax Romana. Right, when there was an outlying nation, people group that were resisting Roman occupation, the Romans would say, here's the Pax Romana, here's the Roman peace you're going to get. You will have peace and security our way. under our swords, under our rule, and you will pay tribute to us in the form of taxes and make our life work. And if you don't, then we will annihilate you, enslave you, and take over all that you have. That was Roman peace. That was the peace and security that the Roman emperor was spouting. So the Apostle Paul is making a very clear reference to the propaganda of his day. But he says, no, if you believe in that peace and security, then sudden destruction will come upon us. Sudden destruction. And he calls that darkness, drunkenness. But you, beloved, are not in darkness for that day to surprise you like a thief. For you are all children of light and children of the day. We are not of the night or of darkness. So then let us not fall asleep as others do, but let us keep awake and be sober. Have you ever been so bone tired that sleep was all we wanted to do? Well, sleep can be a form of escape, right? When our brains are filled with anxiety and our bodies are racked with worry and our bones are exhausted, sometimes sleep seems like the best, cheapest, easiest escape. And isn't that why some people drink, and some people do drugs, and some people go shopping? When we are really, really overwhelmed by life and exhausted, don't we look for some way of escape? Sleep can serve that function. But sleep is also an essential part of a healthy life. When we are healthy and we're living life as we're supposed to, sleep is the natural part of the rest that we seek, and it's a way to be more refreshed to live life, not an escape from life. So he says, then let us not fall asleep as others do. Let us not fall asleep that way, as an escape from exhaustion. But let us keep awake and be sober, for those who sleep, sleep at night, and those who are drunk, get drunk at night. But we belong to the day, and since we do, let us be sober and put on the breastplate of faith and love and the helmet of hope of salvation. We Christians must sleep differently than those who trust in the peace and security of empire. We even drink differently. We drink in the context of the Lord's Supper. We eat and drink to the Lord. We do not drink to escape the hardship of life. But if we plug into the system that has been given to us and told is the good life, then sooner or later we're going to turn to sleep as an escape from exhaustion and drink as an escape from hardship. This American dream is so crazy. You grow up learning to be autonomous, individualistic, self-made. We're taught in this country not to depend on anyone, not to ask for any favors, to make our own way. And then because we don't depend on anyone and nobody depends on us, then we have to depend on money. And because we're not in deep relations with one another, most people are jerks, right? Most people are selfish, narcissistic, clueless jerks. So then when we're lonely and we say, gosh, I sure would love some companionship, we've already spent so many decades being raised to be autonomous individuals, scared for our own safety. We spent so many years making our own way, and if we are in relationship, exploiting other people to make a way for ourselves, that by the time we realize, holy cow, I am really lonely, exhausted lonely, bone-tired lonely, existential crisis lonely, We've spent so many years pursuing our own interests, acting like selfish jerks, that nobody wants to hang around us. And then we have to have some hook to get people in our lives somehow. Maybe the other person is just as lonely as I am. Maybe the other person is just as desperate as I am. Maybe the other person is just as much a selfish jerk as I am. Okay, well then, let's have a friendship. We'll call it hanging out. Hey, are you free? Want to hang out? Yeah. And at first, it's fun because you go drinking together. When life sucks, we drink. And it's better and more fun to drink with somebody, even if the other person is just as much a jerk as I am, than to drink alone. But then after you drink for a while, you start talking. And it's stupid banter at first, because what kind of talking do you do when you're drinking? But you can't drink all the time. And then you start talking, and the more you talk, the deeper you get, and the deeper you get, the more intolerable the other person is, right? Because below the drinking and the laughter and the stupid stories and talking about the weather and things, they're really a selfish jerk, and that's who you're hanging out with. But the other person finds you to be a selfish jerk too. And so it eventually falls apart. And the next thing you know, we're looking for another friend to hang out with, who's just as much a narcissistic, lonely jerk as I am, to spend a few lonely hours with. This is America. This is what our society has come to. It is so pathetic. We have invested all our time and energy in making it on our own, to make money, to have our retirement and our safe bank account and our stocks on Wall Street, so that in case everybody fails around us, we at least have money. We at least have financial security. And guess what? That's exactly what we got. Where we put our money is what we got. We have not invested in deep relations. We have not invested in our own Christian character to be loving, gracious, kind, gentle, generous, hospitable, to consider the needs of others more than our own needs, to be servants of one another rather than seeing how we can exploit others to serve us. We have spent our energy and investment in being jerks. And then we wonder why we're so lonely, why we're so alienated, why we're so exhausted from life. When we have to do everything by ourselves, it's exhausting. But when a whole bunch of people do things together, it's fun. It's called the Tom Sawyer effect. Try it. But you can only exploit people one or two times, right, before they catch on. So we actually have to be people that people want to hang around. We have to be good people, really deep, really deep. And then the Tom Sawyer effect is permanent. People want to help you, be with you, and you want to help other people. We're servants to one another rather than exploiters of one another. That's what the Roman Empire was basically saying. Peace and security. You give us all of your time and energy, your labor, and then we will give you a certain kind of imperial order. But the loyalty was to the state. God bless Rome. And the roads and the aqueducts and the ships and the monuments and the temples. God bless all that Rome is building. The greatness of Rome. Roman exceptionalism. And you do that and you work all to build up the glory of this state. And then you'll have some self-esteem. You might have some financial security. You might have a house. You might have retirement. But the natural way of being human, of being family, of caring for one another, sacrificing for one another, was all eroded as the Roman Empire increased its power, just as we are experiencing now. We have rules and regulations that make no sense. We should be able to live where we work. If somebody has a coffee shop on street level, they should be able to live on the second floor. And then their neighbors and best friends should be able to live on the third floor. But there is a reason why those laws exist in our books. And it's not for the well-being of our families or our society. It's certain people out there that want to make money no matter how degraded our daily life is. When are we going to wake up? When are we going to be sober? When are we going to sleep to be refreshed so that when we wake up in the morning, we see clearly? Rather than sleeping as one more form of escape from our dehumanized way of life. I'm really concerned about whether sociality, relationality has been eroded so deeply in us as Americans that if we're capable of recovering community and humanity, have we already become such individualistic, narcissistic, self-centered, self-referential jerks that others cannot tolerate us and we cannot tolerate others in any meaningful, sustained way? That's really one of the fundamental questions we are asking at Church of All Nations. It's not looking good, but we have not lost hope. And so we need to reorient our lives a little differently. How much energy are we going to spend saving up for retirement? I mean, it's nice to have a home and money and things like that. I'll give you an example about my parents, since many of you know my parents. My parents were teachers in Korea, and they were good teachers. They were successful teachers. But I don't know what it is about teachers, doctors, and pastors, but they make awful business people, right? Doctors make a lot of money, but they try to invest that money in business, is all down the drain, right? Never met a doctor who made it in business. Same thing with pastors, same thing with teachers. It's just something about being good at one thing makes us bad at something else. But my parents couldn't speak English, so they were not able to teach in this country. That's one of the benefits that many African immigrants have, is that some of them have English as one of their national languages, but that's not the case in East Asia. So they weren't able to teach here, so they had to work in small businesses. And they were really, really bad at it. And I had to work in my parents' business as a high school student and college student to help make it work. So in the end, they did not end well, and they basically ended with no assets by the time they retired. So they had no retirement accounts. But they trusted that God would provide. And my father, who was an atheist in Korea, became a Christian in this country, struggling and finding God, meeting his needs in a very deep way. Became a Presbyterian elder. My mother became a leader in the church. And they were faithful in the Korean immigrant church all their lives. And somehow the children did okay. And they lived with us for a dozen years. And now they're living under the care of my older brother in Korea. It's amazing that despite retiring in their early 60s with zero assets and zero retirement account, they just trusted that God would provide. Not that they're fully functional or anything, but they did really invest in relationships. And it's those relationships that have been their social security in old age. My parents lived that way. I plan fully to live that way too. I do have a retirement account through the denominational plan and all those things. But really, you are my social security. I'd rather spend my time investing in this community than in money-making schemes, of which I have many in my brain. Ask me about them, okay? I did major in business management. I said I'm bad at business, but that doesn't mean I'm bad at business ideas. So for those of you who want some good business ideas and want to give me a cut, talk to me. But I know myself, I'm not to go into business directly myself. This is total aside. Please do not pay attention to the last 23 seconds. What I'm trying to say is that it's this family that I'm invested in. And whatever needs I have, I know you will meet them. Just as you have come over the years to depend on me to meet some of your needs. Among us here in this congregation, we can fix just about any problem. Did you know that? I know that because I'm your pastor. I know the gifts, the talents, the multiple intelligences, the abilities of our people. We can solve so many problems together if we come together as family. But if we don't trust each other, then we're going to have to trust something else. And if we trust something else and put all our energy in that something else, then that's all we got. I know too many Americans that basically grow old alone. Thankfully, that's not the case here among our people here, but there are too many out there for which that is the case. What is the point of having things and not having people? I don't know about other people, but for me, the most fun thing is other people. The most fun thing is being with other people. The most tiring thing is being with other people. The best thing is being with other people, and the worst thing is being with other people, right? The greatest joy and the greatest pain. The greatest triumph and the greatest tragedy. But still, what's the point of life if we're not going to experience life fully? So yes, there's pain, there's suffering. We just have to build up our resilience level, right? And when we've gone through enough pain, we accept it as part of life. But then the gain of human relations is just so much greater. I believe that Jesus has called us to build up our life together in preparation for Jesus' coming. But there's another school of thought. I'll just make it rated PG and call it the screw it school of thought, right? We're messing things up big time. We can all sense that. And so there's a group of Christians who basically said, screw it. We'll just keep making a mess. And when mommy, daddy, you know, when Jesus comes again, they'll fix everything. But holy cow, look at the mess we made. Do we really want to clean all this up? Or do we just say, screw it, and break more stuff and just go hog wild because mommy and daddy coming anyway? I think that's what many people have chosen. But I don't think that that's what the Apostle Paul is recommending to the sisters and brothers at Thessalonica. He says, for God has destined us not for wrath, but for obtaining salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us so that whether we are awake or asleep, we may live with him. In life and in death, we are going to be one with Christ. Jesus is coming again, that is for sure. For you yourselves know very well, it says in verse 2, that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. We don't know when, but Jesus will come again for sure. Are we to just say, screw it, and let the world go to hell in a handbasket? Or are we to prepare for his coming? I believe in the latter. I believe that however much we have broken our society, broken our families, broken our own minds, that we are to put ourselves together. And it's not going to happen through the peace and security spouted by our nation states. Whether from my home country of Korea, or the U.S., or Rome, there is no peace and security in the nation state, only in deep human relations. Therefore, encourage one another and build up each other as indeed you are doing. Encourage means to give courage. We give courage to each other and say, even if we lose our jobs, we will have each other. Even if we don't have housing, we will provide housing for each other. Even if we have a health care gap, we will somehow care for one another the best we can. We will be each other's social security. When we give courage to one another, we don't have to sell our souls to our degrading society. We don't have to make it under the terms of our nation-state values. When we truly care for each other and come through for each other, we have a whole different basis for courage, for peace, for security. Therefore, encourage one another and build up each other. This is the vocation, the task of the church. We are to love each other and know each other so deeply that we care for each other in this way. That means the way we live, the way we sleep, the way we wake up, the way we work, the way we eat, all of that is going to have to come under renewed scrutiny. We're going to have to reconsider everything about the way we live and ask if we are nothing but the victims of corporate social engineering, right? Is that what our life is? Oil companies and auto companies, engineering society, and us living as if that is a God-ordained inevitability? Or are we as a Christian society going to ask some deep questions of what it means to be human and humane? What it means to be disciples of Jesus Christ that lives in such a way that we don't need sleep or drink as forms of escape. But that sobriety, alertness, wakefulness, Jesus as light of the world becomes our true good news. We don't know all the practical answers, but we know that the way we're living now is not working. By their fruits ye shall know them. When most of us are fearful, anxious, self-centered jerks, this is not the fruit of the kingdom. When we have that difficult a time getting along with another human being, living together with one another, this is not the fruit of the kingdom. That means we have bought into the peace and security of our systems and not of the Prince of Peace, Jesus Christ. When we are profoundly Christian, we can love and live and relate with anyone. And we will even be able to overcome and overwhelm our enemies with love. This is the power of Christian love. Sooner or later, even our enemies will be worn down through the love of Jesus in and through us. So this is where we practice. The church. The church is where we practice. And the church is where we make endless mistakes. The church is where we get cuts and bruises, but we don't die. Right? The church is boot camp. We have to practice this here so that we are encouraged to go out into the world and be good news to a world desperate to hear it. Amen. Let us pray.